there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 407. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to Ken at thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have yet another jam-packed episode for you this week. Let's get started by introducing our first two guests to you. This past week, my loyal listeners, a very special thing happened as the Alice Austin House in Staten Island, New York, was designated as a National Site of LGBTQ History. The Alice Austin House was already widely known as a nationally landmarked museum devoted to the trailblazing American street photographer Alice Austin, who we will talk all about, but now the site has become the 14th site nationally to earn this LGBTQ designation under the New York City Historic LGBT Sites Initiative out of more than 92,000 places on the National Register. Here to talk about all about this truly important event is Joan Byron, Jeb, an award-winning documentary photographer and filmmaker who has been chronicling the lives of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals for more than 30 years, and Janice Monger, the executive director of the Alice Austin House, and I always must highlight a fellow NYU graduate, which, you know, we always got to point that out. Joan, Janice, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, thank you.
I am so excited to have you. Oh, this is such an absolute pleasure. We're gonna start with you, Joan. Before we even talk about the site, we should tell our listeners about Alice Austin. For those of our listeners, and I would put myself in that, before I did my research, I didn't know a lot about Alice Austin. Where do we start in educating the populace about the importance of Alice Austin?
Well, we are hoping that more and more people will know about Alice Austin, because in addition to being a truly wonderful photographer, technically and aesthetically, she has some of the earliest and most fun pictures of women together. Playful pictures, erotic pictures, pictures of women in bed, pictures of women doing all kinds of activities that were very new to women at the time. She was more than a street photographer. She is primarily known for going into Manhattan and doing those images of people on the streets, but she also had a very important series of pictures of immigrants and the quarantines that immigrants who were thought to be ill were put through on islands that were near Staten Island, and we could talk more about that later. But my interest in her was originally because I was looking for pictures, photographs, images of lesbians when I first came out, and I couldn't find any, and I researched and researched, and I was just so thrilled when I found Alice's work.
Unbelievable. Oh my gosh, this is someone we all must know. Janice, I'm going to read you a sentence that you may or may not know. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. The sentence reads as follows. The Alice Austin House fosters creative expression, explores personal identity, and educates and inspires the public through the interpretation of the photographs, life, and historic home of pioneering American photographer Alice Austin. I feel like you know that sentence.
I do indeed. That is the mission statement for the Alice Austin House. And as you mentioned, we're on Staten Island, and it's a public museum that is in the Austin family home, which was one of the earliest homes in New York. So it's now open to the public, and we have period rooms from the 1890s to show what Alice and her family's and Gertrude's life was like in the Victorian era. And then we also show changing exhibitions of contemporary photographers as a way of continuing her legacy, and a whole range of public programs like concerts, and We have yoga on the lawn in the summer. So, you know, we really try to keep up the spirit of Alice Austin. And so the board and I wrote that mission statement just a couple years back to really update it and show where we were headed. And this embracing of Alice and Gertrude's story and telling it, as well as what that means for the LGBT community, is signaled in that exploring personal identity. And that's really part of our mission that we're bringing forward. And this announcement on Tuesday is a big part of that.
A huge part of that. And tell us about the feel of the space, Janice. I have not been in the space, but, you know, each museum to me, I'm a sociologist, so I'm always interested in the feels of different places and how it affects people. Set the Alice Austin House apart from all the other sites out there in its feel and the spirit it puts forth.
Sure. And it's very easy to set apart. It's true. So the Austin family dubbed the site Clear Comfort. And if you come here, you really sense that still today, even though, you know, the Austins lived here over 100 years ago. The house was originally built as a one-room Dutch farmhouse from 1690. And the location is right on the kind of north to eastern shore of Staten Island, so right near the Verrazano Bridge. And we're really only about 100, 200 feet back from the waterfront of looking over the New York Narrows that leads into New York Harbor. So it's a very prominent location, and it was historically in terms of being right at the entrance of New York Harbor, where, as Joan mentioned, all the immigrants were coming into the newly opened Ellis Island. You know, this place has been witness to a lot. So the kind of site itself is amazing, and with these panoramic views from the New Jersey skyline all the way, you can see the Coney Island parachute jump. And we look directly across to Bay Ridge. And then the house itself in its preserved form from Alice Austin's time is a really charming Victorian Gothic cottage. And it's one of the fine examples that still exists today in New York City. And so you walk in and you feel like you're entering a home rather than an institution. And I love that about it. It's just a really magical place because you can still walk on the porch and the pathways and this bench that's around a tree, just as you did in Alice's day, and see her pictures, you know, of herself and her family and her friends and Gertrude right on those very locations. And one of the great features in the house is there's a storage room upstairs that served as Alice Austin's dark room, just this tiny, you know, closet. And you can go up in there and there's still the cabinets and the hooks. And we have some of the cameras and equipment that she used on view. And I really do feel like you sense her presence there, having spent hours and hours developing her photos.
Amazing. Amazing. Now, Joan, I do not mean to boil your career down to one word, because your career, we can spend days and days talking about your career, and I just want to meet you in Northampton one day and just look at all your stuff with you there at Smith, because it's just such incredible work. But one of the words that I see throughout your work over the years is this word visibility and the importance of visibility. Talk to our listeners about Alice Austin and visibility and why her work matters in that way.
I'm very happy to do that because I have enormous admiration for what Alice did. Though she did not make her pictures of her friends and her lover and her social circle public at the time that she took them, the fact that alone that she made these images is phenomenal because it was assumed by everybody that you could not talk about this. I mean, you know, we're at the end of the 19th century. We're not even in the 20th century for most of her life. And these images are so transgressive. They're so iconoclastic, both in terms of her gender and her sexual orientation. And they're so much fun, as I mentioned before, that she has gifted us with a visibility of lesbian life in the Victorian era that I think has nothing comparable.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of research in this area, and it's so satisfying to me that we have this new designation that recognizes the whole of Alice Austin, so that we can talk about her personal life. Now, she would probably not have used the word lesbian because it had different connotations at that time. I call her a lesbian because I think if she were alive now, she would more easily embrace that label. But she spent her life with the love of her life, Gertrude Tate, and with these friends who just enjoyed basically visually giving the finger to all the expectations that they were supposed to meet as nice young Victorian ladies, both in their behavior and their dress. And, you know, they liked to get into drag. They liked to smoke and show their ankles and all that sort of thing that was not supposed to be done. So I think the fact that we saved these images made by Alice, I think she, you know, I mean, I don't know, but I identify with her on a lot of levels as a lesbian and as a photographer, and I think she would be very happy that we get to look at the work that she did in her private sphere today.
Let me push you further on that. It strikes me, Joan, that this work is also particularly salient as we put it in our current political context. You know, if we're talking about immigration, if we're talking about equality, it strikes me that Alice Austin's work is a key piece of having that conversation.
Well, you know, she was not a social reformer in the way that some of the photographers, especially in New York, were at the time. Somebody, I think, said, you know, she wasn't so much interested in the politics of things. She really just was sort of interrogating them and making this record. So I don't want to, you know, put too much on her.
Right.
But I will say, given the current climate, anytime you can help somebody come out, and I really feel this is a great coming out for Alice Austin, it liberates more people. You know, people will see what she did as a woman who led an independent life, as somebody who was not afraid to document, you know, eroticism among women. That liberates all of us when those things come to light.
If I can jump in,
yes,
here,
please.
Ken, on that point, actually, I think I completely agree with everything Joan just said. And, you know, she wasn't really politically active necessarily, but I think, you know, the way that we view Alice Austin is that, you know, in the way that she lived her life, you know, she broke these rules and expectations, and that makes her, you know, a kind of inspiration to the LGBT community, but also in terms of feminist history and
yeah.
all of these different avenues. And she wasn't necessarily a suffragette either, but, you know, I've been taking part in New York City's efforts around the suffrage centennial on the steering committee, you know, because of the way she lived her life on her own terms. And in that way, you know, she contributed, I think. But to your point, you know, that's what's so great for the museum to have the opportunity with the contemporary shows, because, you know, we curate solo exhibitions and thematic group shows. So we're able to connect Alice Austin's photography from, you know, over 100 years ago, that's so relevant, as you're saying, to issues that we're still facing today. And I feel like this is our opportunity with really taking on this part of our mission. I've educated myself a lot because I'm an ally, and I feel like it's so meaningful. We've heard this from Joan and from others, how meaningful it is to know that you know, Alice lived this way, and that there's these early, this early relationship to look at and really respect, and to know that it's okay, and that that's something we're still working on today.
You know, Janice, in a phrase I don't think I've ever said in 9 years of doing this show, but I'm still going to put it out there, let's talk a little bit about museum management. What are the challenges in getting people to visit the space, and how can we all support overcoming those obstacles?
Oh, thank you so much. I love this. So, you know, I should say that the Alice Austin House is, you know, we're actually in a New York City park. So the New York City Parks Department owns the house and the grounds. And then I work for the Friends of Alice Austin House, Inc., which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So we'll make a plug that all contributions are tax deductible.
Yay.
But, you know, we work in partnership with New York City Parks. And then we're also part of Historic House Trust of New York City that helps be a liaison for 23 different historic houses around the city. So we sort of have different networks. We're also part of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, Historic Artist Homes and Studios Group, which is really fascinating. 32 sites around the country that are, you know, preserved artist homes and studios. And so that's, we've tried to really emphasize the studio part of what happened here at Alice Austin's house too. So, you know, we do rely on individuals and foundation and government and corporate support to, you know, meet our annual operations. So, you know, that's, it's something that all nonprofits and culturals, you know, have a hard job doing, but we are succeeding and growing, and we can use your support to move forward. I should also mention, as part of this, in addition to this amazing designation, we recently received a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to undertake updating the permanent installation, the permanent display of Alice Austin's photographs at the museum. So that'll be happening over the next 2 years to really incorporate this. So I think there's a number of ways that people can help in this effort, with expertise, with volunteering, with donations. And, you know, we'd love to have people come here. I think one of the great things is the Staten Island Ferry is free. And, you know, that's how Alice Austin traveled too. She also was an early women's bicyclist. So, you know, we're a bike-friendly location. So it's not that hard to get here. So please come and experience this amazing place.
Nice. Well, we've talked about the designation. We've inserted it into our dialogue. But let's attack it a little bit more directly, because you both are approaching this from a different lens. And so I'll ask the same question to both of you on the significance of this designation. Well, we'll start with you, Joan. You know, as a photographer and as a filmmaker and as a historian, why is this designation important?
Well, it's very important. But let me first start by giving a shout out to the New York City LGBT Historic Sites Project.
Yes.
Which is the group who did all the documentation for the nomination that got us the designation of the house. I am also, I like to think of myself as somewhat of a preservationist in the LGBT community, and I would encourage your listeners to support those groups in their own localities, wherever they are. We have a lot of groups across the nation now, and part of what we're doing, and of course, it was easier under the prior administration, and it got a lot of momentum, and we're trying to keep the momentum going, is that we are making LGBTQ lives part of American history, where they have been totally erased and obscured and absent for so long. And when we get something put on the National Register of Historic Places or made into a national landmark by the National Park Service, which is part of the Department of Interior of the United States government, it's very hard to undo that, actually, even if you might want to.
Right.
So what all of this does, and what the Alice Austin House is a huge part of, because it is a landmark, and there are so few landmarks that have this designation, is open up American history to queer people, to being seen and recognized and included in a way that is really quite new.
Yeah.
And I know from all the work I've done throughout my life how important it is for LGBTQ people to have some reflection, acknowledgement, idea of their presence in history. I have said for a long time, without history, you're kind of rootless. You almost feel like you don't exist on a certain level. So, you know, having this clear comfort, this wonderful home that was the home to Alice and Gertrude, not only rescued and restored and made into a museum, but to have it recognized not just for its architectural importance, not just for the historic importance of Alice as a photographer, but for the significance of Alice as a lesbian photographer, which is basically what this is doing, is just wonderful.
And how about you, Janice, from the perspective of just being in this incredible space, how does this designation support your work?
Well, I love what Joan just said. It's so eloquently.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do also want to give the acknowledgement to NYC LGBT Historic Sites Project, and who, you know, helped undertake the amendment to our National Register of Historic Places listing, which is the technical thing that happened. We updated the amendment, and it's adding the area of significance of LGBT history. So it was written by Andrew Dulcart, who's a professor at Columbia, and the group at NYC LGBT Historic Sites Project that does have an interactive map of sites all across New York City online. So that's part of a larger endeavor that you should check out too. And, you know, we also partnered with the State Historic Preservation Office to undertake this work. So for me, this is very powerful. I think that this is something, when I came in as a director and with our current board of directors, that we knew we needed to do and wanted to do. And I must say, you know, in some ways we're catching up, right? I have to say that we stand upon efforts and work that has been done, you know, for decades to try to bring this awareness to Alice Austin of the LGBT orientation, and also Alice and Gertrude's story and relationship and the loving, devoted relationship that they had for 50 years. And they lived together here at this home for 30 of those years. So there were people who, you know, tried to make this visible in the past, like the Lesbian Avengers, and Dyke Magazine featured Alice Austin on the cover. And, you know, the Staten Island Pride Center has been so supportive. So there's all these people that, you know, I feel like we're resting on the shoulders of their work. And, but I'm very proud to achieve this for this organization and be part of this larger effort that, you know, I think it's another level of legitimizing, right, all of these things. And, you know, we firmly believe that history is not fixed, and that LGBT history is American history. And so our standpoint in terms of how we're integrating the story is just that it's this Alice and Gertrude's relationship in the new iteration here will be part of the core interpretation and the core story of this house. And I think to have the, you know, national government recognize that is so important in bringing awareness, you know, to the LGBT community, but the broader public of Alice Austin and Gertrude Tate, their relationship, her importance as a photographer, the importance of this site as a place of American history.
There it is. Very important stuff. Last question. Joan, if you think that you are going to be on this show this week and I'm not going to ask you about the Furies Collective, you are sadly mistaken. If our listeners don't know about the Furies Collective, there's just no way that I could possibly start from scratch and tell everybody the importance. But I would just ask you, in our current climate, how can the lessons of the Furies Collective help us in navigating a path forward?
Wow, that's a big question.
I know.
Let's talk about the Furies house for a minute.
Yeah.
We're talking about houses. I'm very pleased to say that as part of the LGBTQ preservation efforts, the Furies house was the first explicitly lesbian site to be added to the Register of Historic Places. So that was part of this whole historic wave of coming out that I was talking about. The Furies in the early 70s was a lesbian, feminist, separatist collective. Mostly what we did was work on theory. I think the theory had a big impact at the time. Today, I think we don't need theory. We need action.
Nice.
I think we don't need separatism. We need to work together. So I would not hold up the Furies as the way to go in fighting the horrible, repressive, bigoted, mean, and ugly things that are going on in our world today. I would say the spirit of being furious that these injustices are happening, are still part of our national fabric and are coming out of the corners and the woodwork in a truly frightening way. I think to be angry, to be active, and to just not care what other people think, which was a big part of what the Furies were. We really were not caring about anybody who didn't like us. I think that is the spirit that I would take and use today.
I needed to hear that from you. Thank you. Thank you. This past week, listeners, we all celebrated as the Alice Austin House in Staten Island was designated as a national site of LGBTQ history. You can visit the Alice Austin House. It is at 2 Highland Boulevard right there in Staten Island. You must go learn more by going to aliceaustin.org. That's Austin, AUSTEN, because we want you to get that right. Right there at the Alice Austin House, we have Janice Monger, the executive director, and a whole staff and board and volunteers who are doing incredible work. And if you do not know the work of Joan Byron, of Jeb, this award-winning documentary photographer and filmmaker who has been chronicling the lives of LGBTQ individuals for so long, you must learn more. Joan, Janice, I so appreciate your efforts to bring forward the visibility of an individual who captured our lives. You know, we've been saying this for so many years on the show and for so many years in the movement. It is so important that we see our lives represented in all facets of society. And Alice Austin was doing this work, and not enough people know about that. And so there's empowerment in that, and there's validation in that, and there's certainly celebration in that. So I honor the work that you both have done, and I'm excited for you both to keep doing it.
Thank you so much. And I did just want to mention quickly,
please,
that Joan or Jeb is also giving an artist talk at the museum as part of this celebration, so we can hear from her about the lesbian photographers that she's spoken about throughout her work and her own photography. And we'll have documentation of both events, you know, available on our website and Facebook and other things. So even if you aren't attending, you can experience it in some form.
Wonderful. I am excited to visit when I am next in New York City. Both of you, please keep doing the incredible work you're doing.
Ken, thank you so much for the invitation and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
Oh, it's so funny to be seeing you after so long, girl. Look, I understand. understand that you were not impressed, but I heard you let that little friend of mine take off your party dress. I'm not gonna get too sentimental like those other sticky valentines, 'cause I don't know if you were loving somebody. I only know it isn't mine. Allison, I know this world is killing you. Oh,
all right, folks, and we are back. Well, we are deep in the thick of Pride Month, and in addition to the wonderful individuals out there using their voices to make a difference, there are also so many incredible companies and brands supporting our movement, and one of those is Barefoot Wine, and here to talk all about their efforts is the Barefoot Wine Ambassador, Randy Arnold. Randy, welcome to this show, It's So Gay.
Thank you so much, and thanks for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
How did you first become involved with Barefoot Wine?
You know, I sold the brand through a distributor for a year, and I got acquainted with the founders of our winery, and they decided that they wanted to hire me as well. So, and that was in 1990, so 27 years ago.
Wow, look at that. And what is your wine knowledge? Are you the go-to guy in your friend circle for a good pairing?
Yeah, my mother's family have had vineyards in Sonoma County since 1881, so I grew up in a grape-growing family. So there's wine actually on both sides of my family, vineyards, so it's a very wine-centric life, I would say.
Okay, all right, so someone like me who says that horrible statement of, my gosh, these taste alike, you don't like people like me.
You know, my only rule when it comes to wine is if you like it, it's right.
Okay.
And then I throw all the other world window. So.
All right. That makes me feel a little bit better because I don't do so well. I'm like, that's fine. It tastes good. I'm good. So Randy gives me the stamp of approval on that one. Now, I said in the intro, you know, Barefoot Wine has really been involved in supporting the LGBTQ community. How did your involvement in those efforts come about?
Well, you know, it's my community, so it made perfect sense to be involved from the very earliest days of Barefoot. And I started donating our wines and bubblies to nonprofits instead of advertising. And I really thought that being a part of the community was the best advertising that we could do. And besides, it made us feel so good. So I wanted to continue that. And because the LGBTQ community is my community, it was really one of the first places that I got started.
Wow. Am I hearing correctly that you were the first ambassador there at Barefoot Wine?
Yes, they refer to me as the first barefooter. So today we have barefooters across North America and even around the world that represent the winery. And we're all involved in raising money for nonprofits and also all kinds of nonprofits as well. So that's really, it's a great life to always be helping and being part of the community, a truly great life.
Oh, and I would love to hear more about that. You know, I think we have so many members of our community, Randy, who can get a little bit cynical, which I totally get. Is Pride becoming too corporatized, and should it just be about people and not be about organizations? What does Barefoot Wine bring to the mix? Why is it important that they be involved in these efforts?
Well, the Barefoot Winery, we go back 28 years with support for the community, so that's a very long time, to say the least. And it's very important to me personally, which my mantra in life is, if it's not real and personal, I'm not doing it.
Nice.
So, and that has served me very well throughout my entire career at Barefoot. And, you know, it's wonderful to be standing at a Pride and people will say, you know, why is Barefoot involved? And I'll say, well, you know, this is my husband standing next to me. So this is a pretty important issue to us. We were married in 2008 during the window of opportunity in San Francisco, and we love the idea that our Barefoot Bubbly is served at LGBT weddings as well. So it's a great connection.
I love that. I would imagine that in your time, you have been able to attend an event or two or 200 as the ambassador, correct?
My estimate is that I have poured at 1,200 benefits.
Oh, my gosh.
I joke that I have carpal pouring elbow. But it's the carpal of giving to others. So that's a great thing to have.
If you are going to get workman's comp from one injury, that would be the one that I choose.
Yes. If I go out on carpal pouring elbow, a lot of people in the wine country are going to follow me.
Yeah. I love it. Give me some highlights. What were some events that you worked that you just thought, oh my gosh, it is so incredible to be here?
That happens all the time, actually. I'd say I was Grand Marshal at two Pride Parades during my 25th year.
Oh, wow.
Sonoma County Pride, which is where I grew up. And I went to check in, and I said, what's my contingent number? And they said, number one. And I said, what do you mean, number one? They said, you're leading the parade. And I told my husband, Greg, I said, I never expected to lead the parade. And he's a very funny guy. And he said, you really expect me to believe that?
I love that. Oh my gosh, what an unbelievable surprise and honor. I love that story, Randy.
Oh, it was incredible because I grew up in Western Sonoma County, and to be a part of that community and feel that love and appreciation was really a highlight of my life, I would say.
That's so lovely. And quite a few weddings as well?
Oh, yes, yes. We were married in 08 during the window of opportunity, and then our reception was held 8 months later, and it was a benefit for a nonprofit, so which was really absolutely perfect for us. As you know, my husband and I are both so devoted to raising money for all kinds of nonprofits.
I'm seeing, because I did a little research online, you've done work for the San Francisco LGBT Center. You've done work for the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, which we just adore.
Yes, the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus was actually the first LGBT organization that I donated to. So that was the very beginning of it all. And actually, the founders of our winery had donated to an LGBT nonprofit before they hired me. And Michael was asked by someone when they hired me, aren't you afraid that Barefoot will be the gay wine? And he said, I'm more afraid if we're not.
Yeah, you guys have legitimately staked that claim at this point.
Yeah, we'll sponsor over 200 prides worldwide. So we're doing prides in Latin America and Europe and Asia and even Australia as well.
I am hoping, Randy, that they do not keep you tied down to California, but that they let you go to some other prides as well.
Actually, I've been to a pride in Brighton, England that we sponsored. And this year, I'm very excited. Canada is having their first national pride, and it'll be held in Montreal. And Greg and I are going to that event to represent the Barefoot Winery. So I'm very excited about spending time in Montreal.
Have you been there before? It's one of my favorite places on this planet.
You know, I have not, so that adds to my my excitement because I have heard so many great things. So, interestingly enough, World Pride was held in Toronto a few years back, and our Canadian team created an 80-foot-long Pride banner, and that Pride banner that started in Canada will return to Montreal for the parade. So it has the footprints of LGBT civil rights leaders from around the world. We took actually a camera picture of their feet and then printed it onto this 80-foot-long banner. And the banner has been in probably about 15 pride parades across North America. So it'll be so exciting to carry it in Montreal and have it return to where it really began in Canada for us.
That will be incredible. You know, you have the product. You're out there at Pride. You have the product. People love it. But there's also you, Randy, the person, who certainly are an ambassador for the brand, but you are also Randy. Talk to us about when you're at these events, what is the signature Randy spirit that you bring with you to these incredible experiences?
Well, you know, people have a lot of questions. We're fortunate in wine in that people are really interested in the category, and they have a million questions. And if you just answer their questions, they'll support you in whatever you're doing, right? So there are so many questions. Just being able to answer their questions about wine and finding wines that people enjoy, because we make a wide range. We make 35 different wines and champagnes at the Barefoot Winery. So we hope that there's something for everybody in there. and just allowing people to talk about what their preferences are, how they're going to serve it, and then finding the right wine that matches with their taste level and what they're looking for is really rewarding.
Well, I certainly want some free advice right this second. I'm a vegetarian. I eat a lot of tofu. I eat a lot of tempeh. What wines should I be looking for? Or does it depend more on what sauce I'm using?
You know, I look at wine pairing as lighter and heavier. So dishes that are heavier, I would use red wines. Lighter dishes, lighter flavors, I'd go more to white wines. And there's a lot of exciting choices among those 35 wines and bubblies that we produce. So our Pinot Grigio is actually our number one selling wine for Barefoot, and it's one of the top selling Pinot Grigios in the world. And that's a great place to start with Barefoot. Our driest wine is actually Sauvignon Blanc, which is kind of surprising. It's drier even than our red wine.
Huh.
So that's also a great accompaniment to, I think you're eating lighter styled foods, it sounds like to me.
Yes. And by the way, I enjoy that there are recipes right there on barefootwine.com. I very much would like to make some of the strawberry lime bites. Those look amazing.
Yeah, we do. Drink recipes have become very important. And I think it's the millennial generation are really open to creativity. And that wasn't always the case in wine, but it certainly is now. And we also do, I do cooking with our wines as well. So I say that we do, Barefoot is cooking. And I've actually cooked on stage at home and garden shows with our wines. And people will say, oh, is it okay if I do this? I said, well, if you're enjoying it, yes, it's okay. You can use our wine in a recipe.
Randy, you have given me permission to try so many different things now in the kitchen. I'm so excited.
Wow, that's fantastic. I'm so happy.
Now, when are you getting out to Cleveland? This is ridiculous that you guys are not out here at our Pride. I want you here.
Oh, you know, I just came from Columbus Pride this last weekend.
I had no idea. That's right around the corner.
Yeah, yes. It's really a big, important Pride and a great community there. And I love all the time I get to spend in Ohio. So Ohio is actually one of the states that I introduced Barefoot to. So I got our first distributors and started selling. Actually, we started selling Barefoot in Cleveland, in Ohio. That was our first distributor. If you can imagine, in 1997, I was running around the country trying to get distributors to sell our wine, and it was very difficult. And Cleveland was our first place in Ohio that we were able to sell to. So it still has fond memories.
So there's a connection. There's a connection there, and we have a chance at getting you. I'm thrilled about the brand, but I want Randy to come back to Cleveland.
Oh, I would love to. That would be great.
There you go. There you go. Now, what do you have to say to all of those other brands out there? You know, there are any number of meetings that happen every year in different organizations and different companies trying to decide, well, what should we do with Pride? How involved should we get? What do you have to say to all those boardrooms out there for folks deciding, well, how involved should our company get with Pride this year?
You know, if we can encourage companies to support organizations that are doing great work in the community, that is a wonderful thing. And I am never bothered by trying to get more companies to support our community. So, there are tremendous rewards along the way as well. So it's an example of how capitalism is working well. So corporations support great causes and great nonprofits, and that is returned with support for those products and organizations. And that's a wonderful byproduct of our organization.
Sure is. Sure is. All right. Well, last question. It strikes me, Randy, that you are one of the blessed ones in such a beautiful way, in that you get to merge your life outside of your work with your work, and you meld together, you know, who you are as an individual. Am I getting that right? Because it just sounds like a real beautiful thing that not all of us have the opportunity to do. And I love seeing it in others because it's so inspiring.
Well, you know, I feel extremely fortunate. I mean, I probably spend half my time raising money for nonprofits, and I work for a winery. And that is a really fantastic opportunity. And there's always ways of supporting things that you feel are important. And it, you know, on all sorts of levels. And actually, our founders, Michael Houlihan and Bonnie Harvey, wrote a great book. It's called The Barefoot Spirit. And it talks about the early days of Barefoot and how what they call worthy cause marketing started for the winery. And it's really a fun. We have a great story. We were really wine industry outsiders as well. So the outsiders came along, and we have changed the entire industry. So always look to the outsiders for innovation and change.
Randy Arnold, listeners, is the original Barefoot Wine Ambassador. You can learn more about Barefoot Wine and Bubbly by going to barefootwine.com. They are doing incredible things, and not just the company, but Randy himself, to support the LGBTQ community. They are out there at Prides, and you heard it from Randy. If the wine tastes good to you and it works for you, you're allowed to drink it and ignore all those other peoples who are turning up their noses at you, and that's important to me, and I thank you for that, Randy. And of course, thank you for the energy you and Barefoot Wine and Bubbly are putting out there in the world, because it really does make a difference.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You only know what I want you to.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we still have a little time left on this week's episode, so let's get to some of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. I have to touch briefly on all of this flag ridiculousness. So if you didn't see, the city of Philadelphia, which has been struggling, they have been struggling for years and years now with racist incidents within the LGBTQ community. Well, their pride just happened, and what they decided to do, among many things, just one of the things they decided to do was to introduce an alternative rainbow flag. And at the top of the rainbow flag, there is a black stripe. There is a brown stripe, and it represents their commitment to talking about race, to talking about racism, to being anti-racist in Philadelphia. Well, people have flipped their lids over this flag. People see it as a personal affront. They think they're being accused of being racist. It's an insult. Look, if this was the absolute only response to addressing racism within the LGBTQ community, then sure, I agree. This is not the only thing we should be doing, but it was just one piece of a much larger puzzle. Just one piece of a much larger puzzle. And it wasn't mandating that all of the rainbow flags all across the world now have a black stripe, now have a brown stripe. So I don't think that this is the be-all, end-all to address everything that's happening in our community. But I am quite fascinated that people have flipped out this much. And quite frankly, let's call it what it is. The people on social media who are flipping the heck out are largely white gay men. Now, if you look at the executive directors of almost all of our national LGBTQ organizations, they are almost universally white, and most of them are white gay men. So the fact that people in power are flipping out about the addition of two stripes to one city's flag, it is privilege like you have no idea. One self-proclaimed activist, who I think has actually done quite a bit, wrote an op-ed saying, this is ridiculous. And so I started calling him out on Facebook and saying, why are you so affronted by this one city's, again, one city's addition of two stripes to their rainbow flag? And he told me to F off, and then he blocked me on Facebook. So yes, there's a lot of privilege going on. There's a lot of folks who are just trying to maintain their power structure however the heck they can. I'm less interested in this being the solution, which it's not. Adding two stripes to one city's flag is not the solution. I'm much more interested that this is affronting so many people. So there's that going on. But there's more. A retired NFL player has publicly confirmed that he is gay. Ryan O'Callaghan was drafted to the New England Patriots in 2006 and has also played for the Kansas City Chiefs. The player, who is now retired from professional football, opened up about his sexuality with an interview in Out Sports. O'Callaghan explained that he had tried to come out once before, in 2014, when he publicly thanked his boyfriend while receiving an award. However, the news went pretty much unnoticed, so he took the leap again in an interview this week. He explained to OutSports of being in the closet. He said this, quote, "I used football as a cover for my life. Football was the most masculine thing I could do, so I decided to dedicate myself to football. No one is going to assume the big football player is gay. It's why a football team is such a good place to hide." He also said this, quote, "Being gay wasn't just a small detail in my life. It consumed it. It's all I would think about. But now that I've come out, it rarely crosses my mind. I'd go about my daily life in football, but thinking about hiding it and hoping no one finds out and being ready for any situation was exhausting. My plan was to end my life after football. I thought that would be it, and I could never be an out gay man. I'm just glad there were people who pushed me in the right direction and I could get help." So huge congratulations to Ryan O'Callaghan, a former NFL football player who has now come out. We just got to get people who are actually playing, active players. I love when anybody comes out, retired or active, but it would be amazing if we could get some active players to come out, because surely there are active players who are gay. They're just not out of the closet. The struggling National Organization for Marriage drew a crowd of fewer than 50 people. 50 people, less than 50 people, to a homophobic rally in D.C. last weekend. The group, which was formerly the largest and most influential anti-gay marriage pressure group in the United States, held their annual March for Marriage in Washington, D.C. Attendance at their rallies has been dwindling for some time, and in recent years, organizers have resorted to busing in protesters from affiliated churches. This year's event was the most lackluster, and you have to see pictures of this. It's so sad and yet so appropriate. Less than 50 people showing up to the group's big rally despite extensive promotion online to their supporters. A Facebook invitation for the event attracted an impressive zero. That would be zero confirmed attendees. The group sent dozens of mailouts to supporters encouraging them to attend and spared no expense constructing a large platform for the event. You gotta see this platform, and there's no one standing in front of it. The eventual crowd would have been outnumbered by a visiting school group. They are on their way out. So keep holding events, and let's keep taking pictures of how few people are showing up at these events. A private school in Indiana that receives taxpayer funding is coming under fire after claims that they have discriminatory policies towards LGBTQ students. The Lighthouse Christian Academy in the city of Bloomington, Indiana, they say in their admissions brochure that they reserve the right to deny admission to LGBTQ students because their lifestyle is prohibited by the Bible. This has become a talking point across the states after a heated debate last month as to whether schools that receive money from taxpayer-funded vouchers should be able to discriminate against certain groups of students, including LGBT students and students with disabilities. The Academy currently receives funding from taxpayer-funded vouchers under the School Choice Program. President Trump's administration is now looking at taxpayer-funded vouchers as a way to expand school choice, but there is no clear plan in place. We will certainly keep our eyes on that story. You know, we talked last month about the census data, and indeed, Trump officials have now revoked Obama-era requests for data on LGBT people to be collected in the census. Under President Obama, a number of government departments had formally requested that the U.S. Census Bureau begin collecting data on sexual orientation and gender identity through the ongoing American Community Survey. Documents published by NPR show that Obama's former Housing and Urban Development Secretary, Julian Castro, had argued that, quote, "valid, reliable, and nationally representative data on sexual orientation and gender identity are essential to the government catering for LGBT people. That's how we direct money to programs." Meanwhile, the Department of Justice under LGBT ally Loretta Lynch had also formally requested that the Census Bureau consider a new topic in the ACS relating to LGBT populations. However, under Donald Trump, that decision has been swiftly reversed. Letters obtained and published by Democratic Senator Tom Carper show that the Trump Attorney General Jeff Sessions and the Department of Justice, they vetoed the inclusion of data on sexual orientation and gender identity. After the transition to the Trump administration, an official representing the Census Bureau had written to the Department of Justice suggesting the appropriateness of the measure had been questioned. The letter asks the Department of Justice to confirm whether it would like to proceed with the Obama-era request. The letter says this, quote, "It has come to my attention that the Department of Justice officials have recently contacted Census regarding the appropriateness of certain sexual orientation and gender identity topics on the upcoming American Community Survey. As you know, it is the prerogative of the Department of Justice to determine which topics it wishes to propose for inclusion in the survey. In order to meet certain statutory reporting deadlines, my client, Census, seeks to determine whether the Department of Justice continues to view the placement of new content related to LGBT populations in the American Community Survey as necessary to meet the Department of Justice's continuing needs and priorities." In response, the Department of Justice, they withdrew the request and they just said no. So again, more confirmation that in the next census, in the 2020 census, there will not be questions on LGBTQ identity. I know it's not the sexiest topic out there, but this is how the government decides how to spend money. They use census data. It's called demography. And this data will not reflect LGBTQ identity. It's just such a shame. Such a shame. Six people have resigned from the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS, stating that President Trump and his administration do not care about the cause. This is a really big deal. All six of them resigned after they felt that the president was imposing regressive policies in healthcare. The council was created in 1995 with the aim of providing advice, information, and recommendations to the Secretary of Health concerning the prevention and cure of HIV and AIDS. In a joint resignation letter, the group wrote that they had dedicated their lives to fighting HIV and AIDS, but felt that the Trump administration was preventing them from doing this successfully. They wrote this, quote, "As advocates for people living with HIV, we have dedicated our lives to combating this disease and no longer feel we can do so effectively within the confines of an advisory body to a president who simply does not care." They went on to write that the current state of the advisory board, which is also known as PACHA, was concerning. They said this, quote, "The Trump administration has no strategy to address the ongoing HIV and AIDS epidemic, seeks zero input from experts to formulate HIV policy, and most concerning, pushes legislation that will harm people living with HIV and halt or reverse important gains made in the fight against this disease." This is one of those topics, folks, that you have to raise your voice about. These six people resigning, of course it got lost in the news shuffle, but six people resigned from the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS, and these are six lifelong advocates, people who have dedicated their lives to addressing the epidemic of HIV and AIDS in society, and all six have now said, there's just no way. There's no way we can serve on this anymore because the administration does not support efforts to curb, to address, to prevent, to educate on HIV and AIDS. So much more work to do. And that's it, my friends. That's all the time we have for this week's episode. Our thanks to everybody doing such incredible work with the Alice Austin House. Our thanks to Barefoot Wines and the work that they're doing. Our thanks to you all for getting out there and using your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. I hope you all are being safe out there in Pride. I hope you are being visible out there in Pride. I hope you are raising your fist there in Pride, celebrating being seen, being heard. You gotta do it. It's the way we make a difference. Get out there, use your voice, make a difference. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?